The Balut Kiki Project is a proud member of Bunk Collective.
This is the Balut Kiki Project.
What the f*** is Balut?
Banter for the boys and the girls and us freaks in the middle.
A Kiki is in order.
The Balut Kiki Project.
Uniquely Pinoy.
Unapologetically queer.
Lock the door.
We are serving you unadulterated Balut Kiki in 5, 6, 7.
Welcome back to the Balut Kiki Project. I'm joined by my friend Jeff.
Hey. Mel, so allow me to introduce our guest for this project. This intro is going to be a mouthful, by the way, because the marque is barely able to hold itself up due to the sheer weight of our guest's resume, all right? So he is an author, an artist, and an activist. So Mel, that's a triple A threat for you right there. Equipped with more than 2 decades of advancing diversity, equity, and social justice through award-winning brand management, digital marketing, and creative storytelling in corporate, federal, academic, and nonprofit environments. He recently led the rebrand of no less than a Fortune 500 company, mind you, as the first director of brand, and currently serves as a senior advisor for leaders in government, defense, and intelligence in diversity, marketing, and creative strategy. Unfortunately, he does none of these in the Philippines because he is US-based. He's based in Washington, D.C. He is the author of a newly minted book, which is why he's here with us today, but we'll ask him to talk more than the book. It's a wonderful book about the LGBT plus community and our relationships with family, however we choose to define that word. The book is entitled The Wisdom of Gunkles, which is going to be released end of August. So Bessies, please welcome to the project, the project's very own adopted gunkle, Mr. Michael Dumlao, whether you like it or not.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Ah, thanks for coming over. First of all, Michael, please define gunkle for us.
Right. So gunkle is a portmanteau or a contraction of the words gay and uncle. So very simply gunkle, right? And the way that I use it in my book is that it's really meant to really reflect not just obviously gay uncles, but also every other queer mentor that we have in our life. So I sort of state as a catch-all term. I also introduce other terms in there. And in a lot of my speaking, I introduce things like launties, lesbian aunties, tranties, uncles, kunkles, queeros. You know, we're like baklas, right? So we like to make up words. So I literally made up an entire new alphabet soup of ways to describe LGBTQ mentors and heroes within family. And family in my book is specifically defined as both biological and chosen. And it's really meant to really elevate really a conversation about LGBTQ people and our relationship with the family, however we choose to define it, as you said.
In the Philippines, we call everybody titos and titas, right?
Yes.
And there's like plantitos and plantitas. Yeah, so for people who, yeah, so
thanks to the pandemic, we have plantitos and plantitas now.
Trust me, when I was thinking about coming here today, I was like, maybe I should call it Wisdom of Manoms or something.
Wag naman. We're too fabulous to be called Manoms.
Manong.
But nothing wrong with that, but yeah.
Growing up in the Philippines, when did you know that you were queer?
The joke is that I came out of my mother with a karaoke mic. So I'm pretty sure I was queer from birth. So I was born in Ayala, actually in Makati. And I grew up in Ayala, Alabang.
You're so posh, Michael, huh? From the beginning, pala posh ka na, ha?
We grew up in a small little duplex adjacent to the big houses. So
sure.
although I did also then attend De La Salle, like nearby. So yeah, I know it sounds annoyingly posh, but I promise you I'm not. So I grew up in Makati. My mom worked in the Development Bank of the Philippines. My father worked with the trade attaché. We grew up, I researched this recently for a story that I was writing. I was actually born on the day that Imelda Marcos allowed Ninoy Aquino to go to the United States.
Oh, okay. exiled.
And get his surgery. I was like, oh, okay, that was, you know, prescient. Mm-hmm. I distinctly very much remember, like, growing up, like, there was always that specter, you know, of everything that was happening, you know, with the revolution, with people power. I mean, I literally saw it on TV. I saw it, like, every single time I would visit my mom, like, we'd pass by EDSA once in a while. And so a lot of my childhood is sort of this mix of, like, being adjacent and a witness to parts of revolution, while at the same time also, like, you know, really navigating, you know, this reality that I was very, very quickly getting attuned to, that I was different from the other boys. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I, you know, like many, many LGBTQ, well, especially a lot of gay men, we, you know, like to blame our moms. And the way that I blame my mother is that in the Santa Cruz one year, she decided to make me like the prince, and she put me in like the shiniest.
The Constantino.
Yes, the Constantino. And so there's a picture of me in the draggiest drag I've ever seen a boy put on. It's like
shiniest.
Silver, there's a crown. I mean, like, I look at RuPaul Drag Race crowns and I'm like, that has nothing.
That's nothing.
I was like, holy no.
You should have seen my crown.
Exactly. So I remember, like, you know, the growing up in the Philippines, there was like a lot of just festivals and a lot of like just merriment. But at the same time, there was this, obviously, this background of revolution. But at the same time, there's also this growing realization of myself that, oh, one thing I should also mention is that I'm the eldest of three boys. I'm the eldest in my entire generation of cousins. And so that carried with it also a lot of expectations of, like, I had to carry the family name. I am a Dumlao, right? And, you know, that name in some parts of the Philippines carries an inordinate amount of weight for some stupid reason. I feel, well, I'm proud of it. But I remember just growing up, literally my lolas, especially my paternal lola, really instilled in me a very sort of like strong sense of legacy and responsibility, which, you know, was quite a heavy thing for, I think, a, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old to like shoulder. And then suddenly realizing that I probably wasn't going to, you know, marry the girl that I think they realistically expected me to marry one day, that I wasn't going to, you know, become sort of like the scion that they were expecting that was going to take over the family businesses and go into politics. I mean, I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a singer. Okay. I wanted to be like, you know, everything that
the
I
arts.
Saw. Yeah, I wanted to be in the arts. And actually, another reason why I sometimes blame my mother, I love you, Mom, is that she enrolled me in the Development Bank of the Philippines Summer Art Program when I was like five. So I started in the arts when I was barely.
It's her fault.
It's not her fault. I mean, she put me in art school.
She nourished.
She nourished it, you know? And she force fed me a ton of Sharon Canetta, like, throughout my entire childhood.
Oh, you're Sharonian.
I had to, you know? I mean, so I feel like, you know, she instilled in me a passion for really admiring strong women and expressing myself artistically, you know? And so I feel like my experience in the Philippines was definitely that, until the moment that we had to leave, until the moment that we were given the chance to go and join, you know, my family, both in Australia and then eventually in America. And the Philippines, you know, sort of always became this place that I escaped. And then eventually became more and more the place that I now return to say I go home to.
Did you get what some of us gays experience, where you sort of like get corrected for choosing, you know, the usual, like pink over blue, or choosing something shinier? Did you get that?
Sorry,
like, were your elders, were your titos and titas then, or your mom or your dad or somebody older, were they trying to change you and influence your choices?
So growing up, so my name is Michael, or Miguel, or, you know, all the permutations of Michael that you have in the Philippines. And my nickname was Kilo. And there were times where my dad especially would notice that I would become maarte. Like, I would switch my hands, I would walk a certain way, I would strut the runway before I knew what that meant. And he would call, eventually he started using the word Kilo instead of a term of endearment, but it almost became sort of like a warning shot, almost like a pejorative. So ever since I was like very little, like 4 or 5, I would hear that word and I'd like straighten up, right? That's actually when I first learned the call to code switch, if you're familiar with that term. Because the first time I was like, oh no, I can't be this version of myself right now. I have to be the kuya. I have to be the elder. All of a sudden my wrist like go straight, you know. I would straighten up my back. I would deepen my voice as much as a 5-year-old could deepen their voice. And suddenly, like, aww, I was a soldier, you know, and it was like this moment where I don't know if they necessarily felt that they were training something out of me so much as they were protecting me, because they knew that if I was more effeminate, if I gave into my natural effeminate tendencies, then I would, you know, probably be subject to a lot of teasing, potentially violence, and frankly, bring the family shame because, you know, the eldest son shouldn't be Marte like that.
Yeah. And in your early years, did you have any role models when you were growing up?
I would have
aside
to
from
say,
Sharon Cunneta.
Yes, clearly Sharon Cunneta is there.
I mean, this is going to sound so incredibly cheesy, but my Lola, absolutely. Especially my paternal Lola. She was this just firecracker of a little lady. And she took care of my brothers and I, especially when we started immigrating from the Philippines and lived in Australia and America. But even before that, growing up in the Philippines, you know, she taught me, if nothing else, but I think the very, very first instance of what it means to defy the traditions of what it means to be a person, to what it means to defy the kinds of roles that I think Philippine culture and a lot of traditional cultures impart on people. Mm-hmm. She was a single mother. I mean, she raised my Lolo died when my dad was, I think, 18, so long before I was born. And from that moment, she was basically a single parent. She was also a politician in up in the Ilocos region. She taught as well. She was also a teacher, and she was very, very involved in the community. You know, the big story about her is that she was an intelligence officer. She was a spy during World War II, and she spied for the American government. She posed as a flower girl and would basically go into the Japanese encampments as a flower girl and then gather intelligence and feed it to the Americans. So,
wow. You know,
I feel like, you know, I learned, like, you know, how to gather the tea and throw shade, like, very, very, very.
That is
Filipino Matahari.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, and so we grew up with this tiny, tiny tyrant of a woman with, like, shellacked hair who was always dressed really proper. She also was also the one that taught us that, I think she sort of, like, you know, projected in the future that maybe I may have a hard life because, you know, I think she recognized, you know, my effeminacy. She recognized that I may be gay. And so she taught me some very valuable lessons early on. For one thing, she always said, you know, always speak well, always dress well, particularly because the last thing you want is to be surrounded by people who may not automatically think you're of worth or would value you. Mm-hmm. So don't give them any ammunition against you. Always be better than everyone in the room. Always strive. You know, like, there was this idea basically that I had to, like, scale up, you know, and achieve these heights so that nobody could reach me.
Well, and, you've checked both of those boxes so far. You're doing really well. Speaking well and dressing up well.
thank you. I hope she'll be proud. I think, like, if anything, she was definitely my role model because, you know, she as a single person, a single mother, a single woman, like, in the Philippines, raising three kids, also, you know, growing a business, growing a career and doing all that. She showed me sort of resilience and she taught that to us from a very early age. I think also the other one is definitely my mom, only because she, as I said, clearly has already had such a huge influence in my artistry and my love for music. I mean, I basically grew up with matriarchs and really strong women. So I think that's such, like, I don't know if it tends to be a stereotype, but
it would be. Yeah.
It's definitely true.
Like a strong mother figure, a strong maternal female figure, and then sort of like an absent, well, maybe, father figure.
I'll say my dad, I found out later, it wasn't that he was absent, but he was smart enough not to get in her way. That's how I characterize it. I feel like my dad. You know, I didn't quite understand him until very recently. And then I realized, it's not that you were quiet or you were, I guess you call it, like, mahinhin. You were just smart not to get in the way of your wife's ambitions or to inhibit her true self, which to me is, like, huge for me to finally realize that that's what he was like. And I forgave him for a lot of things eventually when I realized, oh, no, you were just being really smart, you know, in a lot of ways. Avoid trouble. Yeah. Like, he basically, like, really embodied the mantra of, like, happy wife, happy life.
Happy fam. Yeah.
What was your childhood dream? Was it, kasi sa Pilipinas, di ba, we're always like doctor, lawyer, engineer, teacher, and anything outside of that box. If you dared say that you wanted to be a singer, you'd be like, no. So yeah, who did you look up to then?
So I didn't know who this person was until I got a chance to work with them, like 20 years later after I made the realization. And I will never forget, we were on the TV, we were turning on TV, and I saw, like, the TV, for some reason, they were showing a fashion show. And it was this legendary, like, you know, designer from the Philippines. And it was this tiny man who was clearly clearly bakla, but like it didn't matter because he was clearly dressing all these you know, the president's wife. He was dressing like, you know, all these artistas, that he was dressing all these people, and his clothes.
Who was this?
It was Pitoy Moreno.
Oh, it was Pitoy, the dean.
Yeah, the dean. And I remember like seeing some of his shows like as a kid. You know, especially when I was going to art school. Like I think some of the people that I was being taught in actually like was adjacent to his studio. I also got to see, you know, his shows on TV. And so that sort of, to me, like started to evoke, and I also remember my Lola told me you have to dress well, right? So I thought, oh, that's how I want to dress. You know, that's how I want to dress well. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, like that's what I want. I want to create beauty and art that people can wear.
So you wanted to dress like Pitoy, or did you want to dress like the models? I just
I wanted to do both. Like I wanted to like, okay, the person who created the outfits. And I also, in many cases, wanted to wear the outfits. It was also the one of the first times where I started realizing that I would probably look damn good in a dress. It would be years, years later before I finally tried one on. I was definitely one of those like young baklas that definitely tried on my mom's heels.
I've seen your Instagram, Michael. There's a couple of pictures there. I've been
what
snooping.
Can I say? You know, I like to embody all facets of gender.
You go, girl.
And I think the 20-year story later is that I got an opportunity. So I ran for a short while. I ran a boutique PR company here in DC, and when we were famous for creating these fashion shows, specifically sustainable and ethical fashion shows, mm-hmm. And specifically fashion shows that demonstrated, elevated, and really showcased talents from all around the world. It also just so happened that the Philippine Embassy, I had some contacts there in DC, and they said, hey, we have this legendary legendary Filipino designer who wants to do a show, one of his like latest, and eventually found out it would be his final show in America. Would you be interested in helping us produce it? And I'm like, yes, of course. Like, who is this person? And they're like, oh, he's the Karl Lagerfeld of the Philippines. I'm like, okay, I don't know what that means. And it's like, oh, it's Pitoy Moreno. I'm like, okay, that's cute. And then I would like proceed to like, I would meet the staff, and then one day, like we were all basically in the staging area and Pitoy's entire entourage, like had just left the airport, and I was there with my team and my staff, and we were getting ready to work with him and to receive him and receive his people. And I will never forget this. It was like literally that entry. It was like Coming to America. If you remember that movie in the 80s,
Eddie Murphy,
like the doors open and there was like yes. dancers, and then yes. like somebody was like, it was like
feathers.
Or like when they come to New York City and it's like rose petals and it's like, like it's kind of like that. So it was like at the Ritz-Carlton in DC, one of the ritziest, obviously, like, mm-hmm. you know, fanciest hotels in DC. The doors open and in walks like just gorgeous model after model after model after model.
In slow motion, probably in your head.
In slow motion in my head, you know, clearly like doing like the strut walk. And then behind them, there's like this really like harried like assistant. So sort of similar to the character of the Devil Wears Prada.
And then running around.
Was this tiny, bespectacled Edna Mode of a man, of a person, of a human creature. And with backlighting, not only that, they also had backlighting because of the sun behind them. So I was like, what is happening? Who is this person? And then
his entrance was produced.
Yeah, clearly somebody was producing it. And it comes into the rehearsal hall, and I'm like, oh my God, that's the guy. And I finally put two and two together.
That was the only time it dawned on you. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was the only time. Because the embassy gave us very little time. So I had to go fast. And I knew he was a designer. I knew this. But it really wasn't until like I saw him, and then later I saw the clothes, and I saw them, that I put two and two together. I called my mom and I said, why didn't you tell me who that was? She was like, actually, I don't know.
Oh my gosh.
I got a chance to actually work with Pitoy in one of his final shows in America here in DC. It was such an honor.
National artist.
Yeah.
And to be able to meet one of your heroes or someone you look up to, it's not a chance that everyone gets.
Yeah. And it's also something that I think that really taught me that, you know, heroes, you know, people say always warn you, you know, don't ever meet your heroes.
Yes, I've heard that.
Yeah, that's true.
Many times. I actually say, like, you know, you should meet your heroes, even if they do disappoint you, because I think they check you. Like, they show you their humanity. And I think in many ways, it actually makes them that much more amazing because, you know, everything that you admired about them. Because I will tell you this, Pitoy was a bit of a diva.
just a little bit.
He ran that adorable assistant ragged. Like he was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Like, if for whatever reason, like, that person is listening to this podcast, let me just tell you that I still see you, that I still have your cup of coffee that you never drank. I am here for you if you ever want to reach out. You know, oh. That poor person was like
bedraggled.
Yeah. Get draggled. But,
it's,
you know,
probably
but,
true.
But you can sense his passion, but with Patoy particularly, you can sense his passion. And also his assistant and his models, you can see how much they admired him. And also, more importantly, you could also sense the gravitas of what he was representing. He was bringing the best of, you know, Philippine culture, arts, you know, to DC at a time where there really wasn't a lot of visibility for Filipino culture the way it
is. No representation. Now. Yeah.
Very, very little representation, you know. And so it was a, for me, it was to see sort of like how they saw that and they recognized the importance and the gravitas of the moment. And then me like being able to play witness and actually help create the platform for it was really something. And just say that, and I did actually tell him the story. I did tell him, like, just so you know, I remember seeing you in Manila. Like, I saw your shows on TV. And then
did he care?
Oh. He was like, oh, that was my worst collection. Oh.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And then he was just like, oh God, yeah, horrible. Oh. And then of course, like, we proceeded to get drunk and he told me stories about people that I promised to, I would carry.
Oh,
like,
my God.
And I was like, wait, tell me about so-and-so. And also my other hero that I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I was like, oh, buddy, tell me about her. I'm like, so there was a lot of tea spilled. but once again, like, I got to like see his humanity and see how, like, you know, his humanity was also what made him connect also with people in a way that was very genuine and raw, you know, and it was really an honor to see that.
Yeah. And I guess it also makes them more relatable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. More human. So
let's just wait when Michael hits the number one spot in the New York Times bestseller list. And yeah, I feel sorry for your whoever your assistant is.
My assistant, he has the name, is my husband. And he's
okay, well, maybe not so much.
Since you were creative and your mom's enrolled you in all sorts of creative endeavors and classes, was coming out to your family fairly easy compared to other people?
So
how did you... Okay.
Was there a coming out at all since
absolutely. I have like one of those classic, like, quintessential, like, American, like, sort of like, you know, like, there's typical like Netflix stories when you click like LGBTQ teen drama, but it's like,
I kind of heard there's a boy involved, isn't there?
There's a boy, there's a streetlight, there is very much late 90s, no doubt, soundtrack to it.
Okay, bring it.
so my coming out story is also coupled with the fact that by the time I came out, I was a twice immigrant. And, you know, the thing about immigrant stories, especially those of us who are now also, you know, in other parts of the world, I know, Jeff, you're in Australia. I know some of your guests also are in other parts of the world, like Canada and what have you. I think one of the things that we always notice is that when you start to explore your, particularly your Filipino identity away from the Philippines, and you start realizing what it truly means to be a minority, that once again, I go back to that term code switching. You know, it's, you start to learn that just to survive, you have to hide parts of yourself.
Totally.
So, you know, there was a point where I realized that being queer was incidental to just surviving as a brown Filipino surrounded by a majority white culture that was largely hostile to anything that wasn't that. That was particularly true growing up in Australia, where, I mean, my family immigrated to Australia in 1987, and less than, only a little over the 10 years prior, they ended a white-only immigration policy. And that was also the time when there were a lot of refugees, a lot of people coming into Australia, particularly from Southeast Asia and Asia in general, but specifically Southeast Asia. And the Australian identity in many ways back then was still very much Eurocentric. Like, it was this idea that we are Europe, and anything outside of that was considered very much the other. And so, you know, Australia was really where I learned how to try to blend in, even though it's impossible. You know, when you look like us, like, we're definitely not white. Like, I am hardly.
You don't have, you just stand in a corner and you stare.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think part of that was like this calculus, this constant sort of negotiation of like physical, psychological, and personal safety and professional safety eventually. Mm-hmm. And this idea of like, how much of myself can I surface before it is no longer safe? And that was first entirely, frankly, based around my Filipino identity and my ethnicity, because so much of my culture and so much of who I am as a Filipino was not acceptable, particularly in Australian culture and eventually even in American culture, whether it be my food, whether it be how I spoke, whether it be, even my name and my last name. And like, it's like people were just like, oh God, what does that mean? And then the associations with Asians coming to Australia, particularly back then, there was like this predominant belief that Asians were coming over to steal white people's jobs. Right. And so my parents got the brunt of that. My parents got the brunt of a lot of racism, especially in Australia. And then fast forward to immigrating to the United States and thinking, oh, the United States, they're so much more
open,
so much accepting.
They're so much more nurturing. They're so much more advanced, you know, and enlightened, you know. And then you realize that, oh, no, actually,
not really.
It's just a different type.
A different kind of, you know, whereas I feel like in Australia, the racism was very, very, you know, sort of in your face. In America, at least in the parts of America where I live, which is Australia, the racism was much more systemic. It was much more embedded in language, in microaggressions, in just, you know, and sometimes, and even just like, not even microaggressions, just aggressions, like, you know, stymied opportunities or like, you know, just straight up, just like people like stopping you from being able to achieve certain things just because they didn't want you to take away the opportunities from, you know, the majority, essentially. And so there, so all of that is to say is that, you know, I basically grew up, you know, having a conflict with my Filipino identity, you know, in a lot of these majority white cultures. And then you introduce the gay stuff. Like you start to introduce like the gay identity.
We haven't even started with the gay stuff. Being Filipino.
And so, you know, a lot of immigrants, especially in the United States, we have this like saying that, you know, when you come from a, from another country, your house, your, especially if your parents are the parent, the people who bring you along. In my house, it was the Philippines. Outside of the house was America, and I could not bring America inside. I think part of that was my parents trying to preserve, you know, and try to create. And to their credit, you know, they did a good job of like helping us really appreciate our culture and understand our culture, and so that we would not live and grow up to be without our touch points to our
good for them
our roots, right?
Yeah.
But what that also meant was that there was this constant conflict between what was allowable in America and mostly in the Philippines. And what I started to see in American culture was this growing acceptance of LGBTQ people. You started to see more LGBTQ people on TV. For me, the big sort of like cultural touch points were the gay characters on MTV's The Real World, which basically helped inform like my high school friends, like, oh, gay people aren't monsters, you know? You know, from a very early age, I knew that I was different. And I would say like in the Philippines, I knew that I was different. In Australia, when I realized that part of that difference was defined by the fact that I really liked boys and I started having like crushes and boys back in Australia, which is really hard too because Australia tends to have a really toxic masculine culture. And so in a very sports centric. So I was constantly surrounded by like,
you rugby.
Like tough and rough and tumble boys, you know, and boys in speedos and swim trunks, you know, and like, like in swim meets and whatnot. And I was like, ooh, what's this? Am I special? Like, I'm not quite sure. Okay. I'm really into it, but you know, I can't tell anyone. And entire time also my parents were very religious. And so I was told very early on that, you know, homosexuality was wrong. And I was like, well, does that mean that I'm wrong? What does that mean? You know? And then eventually I get to America and suddenly America is where I started to just realize that no, actually being gay is not wrong. And there are people here who may accept me. And so what happened was in high school, I met somebody in, now this is now in Santa Barbara, California.
Santa Barbara.
Which is only like, you know, 2 hours north of Beverly Hills 90210.
But can I ask you this? Wasn't it a lot easier in California where there's more Filipinos than if you were like in Connecticut or in Maine?
Not in Santa Barbara, California, girl.
No.
Really? Even as close
I was probably talking about Daly City.
The Filipinos concentrated themselves back then to Cerritos in Southern California and Daly City up in, and then the rest of us were like stuck in other areas where we were the only one. Okay. I was the only Filipino. I was like one of two Filipinos in my high school.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And we had a Filipino community and it was strong, but at least for me growing up, like I was like one of very few, like literally one of two in my entire class growing up.
Were there other minorities or people of color in your class other than Filipinos?
So the funny thing is like I code switched myself into being Mexican.
Because there were more Mexicans.
Yes, because there was a lot of white, Mexican and other. And the others were Asian and Black.
Were you successful?
I was. I actually, to the point that I got into Mecha. it's a testament to how stupid some of the American kids were, but it's also a testament to my Mexican friends and how they recognized that I needed a safe space.
Yeah.
And that's when I first really learned the value of intersectionality and solidarity amongst ethnic minorities and minorities in general, where Mexican and Mexican cultures became my only safe space in environments where Filipino culture was completely a mystery and non-existent. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of, you know, Mexican friends and Mexican girlfriends. I was literally everyone's like day to their quinceañera. So I was like, I was like the honorary Mexican because it was my safe space. Like that was like mm-hmm. safe little harbor. And then something happened in my high school. Suddenly queer started like popping up out of nowhere, and in mm-hmm. comes in this Leonardo DiCaprio looking boy who was like the star of like community theater. It was actually
White.
So he's white.
Okay.
Listen, I had to have what I have. Like there was very slim pickings amongst the gays. and actually the reason why, I think one of the reasons why I ended up falling in love with him was the fact that he was out. He was out. I was 16. Mm. He was 14. And in the closet. It's kind of like a weird version of like that song in Sound of Music. I was 16 in the closet, he was 14. Out.
So you were Liesel.
Yeah, basically. and so he was like this really out and proud person. And I was like really attracted to that confidence because I didn't have that. I was trying to hide and blend in. And he was a person who was adamantly against that entirely. And to the point that he was also an actor. Once again, remember, I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a performer. Mm. And he was on stage all the time. And I thought to myself, oh my God, this person is really, really cool. I want to hang out with him. And then he thought I was cool too. He wanted to hang out with me. And we started to form a friendship. Now, bear in mind, I did not have a lot of friends growing up, nor did I have a lot of male friends, period. So he was actually in many ways like one of my first true, deeply, like sort of like, you know, really deep friendships that I've ever had with an actual boy. Because all my other friends were mostly female. And so once again, you know, another gay stereotype. So I started forming this relationship. Funny enough, my parents loved it because they were like, oh, thank God.
Finally, you know, a guy friend.
He's a boy, lalake, hindi babae. Like I was like,
but oh,
we're going to be playing basketball soon.
Yeah, like, you are so worried, you know, you're so glad you have a strong male friend, you know, male influence now. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. And so we-
My best friend.
Yeah, my best friend. And so, you know, we started to, you know, grow this friendship. And then eventually he started, you know, basically just coming on to me. And there was this one moment where he would, you know, touch me, like he would stroke my, you know, my fake cheek. And I was like, oh God, no, I can't. Oh, the other thing too, is that he also went to the same church as me. So we went to the same church, my very incredibly homophobic anti-gay church. and he was part of that community as well. And he, you know, so a lot of it was also like, you know, what are we doing? Like, I've got God looking at me. I've got my parents at home. I've got like our friends, and our family, like, and we're not out. No one's really out except for you. Am I going to be guilty by association? What's happening here? But at the same time, I really want to just do things to you. And so I was really conflicted. And then everything basically like culminates in me driving him. So at the time I got a driver's license and my parents begrudgingly let me drive the car, and they let me drive the car to go to church and to go to study group so I could like, you know, study and get A's and be the perfect immigrant child. And then I took him in my parents' car out into the mountains. We went to an amazing party and we came back late. And my mom is sitting up, like literally, it's like maybe like 11 o'clock, almost 12 o'clock midnight. And she is sitting at the kitchen table. I walk in and she's sitting at the table and she's like, Anak, where have you been? Like, what's happening with you? Where have you been? You just took me home like 2 hours ago. You didn't answer your pager. You didn't answer. Like, why didn't you call? And I said, oh, you know, I was studying with friends. And she goes, I know. Like, no, that's no, I don't believe you. I don't believe you. You were with that boy again, weren't you? Is he? I thought it was a good influence, but maybe it's a bad influence. You know, is it what? Is he giving you drugs? So I was like,
okay.
Drugs. You know, she thought it was a drug thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we started arguing more and more. And actually at some point I sort of yelled at her and said, you know, I bring home good grades. I do well, you know, at school.
Yeah.
And I do
well.
church. I'm respectful. I take care of my brothers. Mm. Like, I take care of the family. I also started working. So I'm working, you know, now a part-time job to help with the family, pay the bills. And what I can't have a little bit of fun, you know? Mm. And she said, well, you know what? Remember out there is America, and whatever those American kids say that their parents let them do. This is a Filipino family. You're going to respect us. You're going to respect our, you know, our traditions. And you know what? No, you're not going to allow to, you're not going to be allowed to drive the car anymore. Like, you have no privileges. She next all my privileges to the car. And then I almost said, wait, no, I need the car. I have to take it to work and I have to take my boy. And I almost said boyfriend. Oh. And then she basically said this one thing that basically drew it all out of me. She said, Anak, I feel like I don't know you anymore. I feel like you've drifted so far apart. Like, who are you? I don't know you. And then it just came out of me. I said, no, mom, you don't know me. Because if you knew me, you'd know that I was gay.
And how old were you this when you said 16. This?
16.
Okay.
In high school, yeah. And that I remember very much. It was like, you know, when you look at the Netflix movie of your life, you know, that's when everything just pauses. You know, there's water droplets in the air. There's a fly that's sort of like in suspended.
And then slow motion.
Vibration of silence between us. And then without sort of like skipping a beat beyond that minute of second, nanosecond of silence, my mom goes, I don't care, you're not getting the car.
Okay.
You register what I just said to you, woman? Okay. And then she realized, I know what? Wait, what did you say? And then I had to come out to her twice. I just say, mom, did you get that? And then that's when she started this combination of crying and shaking. I don't know if it was anger or fear. And I looked at her and I said, mommy, do you hate me? And she said, no, Anak, I don't. I don't hate you. I'm just afraid. And she hugs me, she cradles me, and we sob and sob and sob and sob. And then I said, well, what do we do now? She says, well, we'll talk about it in the morning. Go to sleep. You have to wake up early for school. Just promise me, don't tell your father because he's not ready. I don't tell your father. We'll figure out together when to tell your dad. So I go to bed. And literally an hour later, my dad at the time was working a night shift in the post office, which is a very traditional sort of stereotypical job for Filipino immigrants in America. And he had worked a late shift. And I was wondering actually where he was, and he realized, oh, you're a late shift. So I didn't really expect to see him until after school, because he usually worked a late shift and he'd sleep through the day and then we'd see him after school. So I thought to myself, oh, okay, I've got like a couple hours before, you know, hell would break loose. And then I woke up, you know, an hour after that altercation, that moment with my mom. And I remember like being rocked back and forth. And I looked up and I saw my dad holding me, crying, saying, you know, you're my Anak, you're my son, you're my son, you're my son. Aww. You know, I will always love you. You're my son. And he kept saying it over and over again. And it almost felt like a mantra, you know, it almost felt like a protection spell, or I don't know, a reminder. I don't know if it was a reminder more to me than to him. But in that moment, I did feel very comforted and safe. And he did say, you know, I will always love you. We'll get through this. He didn't say we'll get through this, but he said that, you know, he said, we will, you know, just know that you'll always be my son. And then that became basically the start of our journey and their own journey of acceptance and my own journey of accepting that they have a journey to acceptance. Yeah. And then just so you know, like the happy ending is that fast forward 20 years later, they are at my wedding, dancing with my in-laws and my husband. So
that's a wonderful story with your dad, because not a lot of gay kids are lucky enough to have that experience.
Yeah.
It's usually, you know, we've heard stories about gays being yung nilulublob sa tubig.
Or binubugbog
or are sent away, you know, they have to like sleep at a friend's house. So
How did that change your relationship with your parents? So you came out the next day, next week.
By the way, Michael, Mel is not out to her parents.
Thank you for the contact.
So she's asking you for advice.
So it's nuanced, right? I came out to my parents. And remember what I said, it's like, I have a journey of coming out. My parents themselves have a journey of coming out. And part of their journey was our coming out together as a family. And so their immediate ask to me was like, don't tell anyone, don't tell your Lola, don't tell, please. Like, let's just keep this in the family. Let's let's keep this amongst ourselves. Let's hide it. You know, very similar to my childhood of hiding my Filipino-ness, hiding my queerness. Mm-hmm. I'm now going to hide this family secret, which of course then made me feel like, okay, this is a secret that mm-hmm. clearly has, you know, an inert sense of shame because they don't want to talk about it. And, you know, so it made me feel a sort of way, but I also had to respect the fact that this is how they were going to deal with it. Listen, I was just grateful that they didn't kick me out of the house. Like many, many kids that I knew and I had heard and would later discover, it was like, I got it pretty good from the fact that they still allowed me to live in their home. And then, you know, there was definitely the don't tell anyone at church, don't tell anyone this, don't tell anyone that. And so it was definitely a journey. And then I discovered that as a teenager, I'm really bad at keeping secrets and that I am a little mischievous. And there was also a moment where I realized that my love was not something to be hidden and that there was nothing wrong with me. And so I did a thing where I told my parents, I'm going to come out and I'm going to tell the family. And this is several months later. I'm going to tell the family over Christmas because I knew that, you know, shortly thereafter, I would probably end up leaving, you know, to go to college. I would end up. So so point is like, I would end up just basically like departing in some way. And so, part of that story is that departure. I'll get to that in a second. But what I did basically do was I did what anyone who's astute and observant about their family knows that there's always that one tita, that one manang, that one ate who can never keep a family secret.
Oh, surely. Yeah. And maybe two.
The best way to broadcast any news to the family was to go up to that tita, auntie, and say, auntie, I have a secret you cannot tell anyone.
And that's like, the cue.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, my cousins come into my room. They're like, dude, are you gay? Yo. And it was like, it just reverberated. Now, the reason why it was important for me to come out at that moment was because I had decided to invite my still boyfriend over at that time. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of eggshells. I was like, okay. So in general, the family was like, okay, you're gay. Okay. Not entirely a surprise. You literally encompass everything that we expected to be like a buckle up and be like, we kind of already sat on you. Like we kind of were just waiting for you to come out. But in general, the family was just like, okay, fine. Okay. And then my boyfriend comes in and he's interacting with the family. Everyone's really nice to him. He's eating like all the Filipino food. And he's doing all of this in front of my Lola. And at some point I remember my Lola like motioning over to me. And he asked me, he's like, she basically came to me and said, "Sino yan?" And I said, "Yung kaibigan ko po." She was like, "Okay, well, is he taking care of you?"
Oh.
And he said, I'm like, "Opo, he is." And it's like, okay. He's very handsome.
Oh.
And then she walks away and I'm like, she never said it.
Yeah.
But there was like that, okay, that woman's smart. Okay, no, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is that my parents had their own journey. Now the family knows, but now the family knows, the community knows. And I do know my parents actually had several loss of friends because, you know, my parents, there was a moment where actually we got kicked out of church after I came out.
Wow.
The church that we were at did not accept LGBTQ people. In fact, the unfortunate thing was at the time, my parents led worship music. I was actually also the pianist and one of the singers. I swear, if I can like fulfill any more gay stereotypes, I was the young protege music director and music leader of my worship group at my
talk about archetypes.
Yeah, my charismatic church who led the music and the praise music, this gay. And so when I came out and people found out that I was gay, they actually tried to send me to conversion therapy. And my parents also refused because they knew that
good for them.
Bad for me. And then that basically forced an out. And that, of course, reverberated in the community. Many of the Filipino families were like, oh, my God, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with your family? What's wrong with Michael? My parents had a lot of sort of like feelings about that. And I felt that the best way for me to like help them heal and help them sort of like have a space for themselves was for me to leave. And so that's what ended up happening to me. Like I ended up actually departing. First, I moved back to Australia across the Pacific to go to college. And then eventually I would come back for a few months and then moved all the way across the continent to Washington, D.C. by myself. And I feel like a part of the story of how my parents and my relationship with my parents has evolved is that there is something about distance that really does make the heart grow fonder, but I think also makes perspective, it challenges perspective and makes it realize it helps you sort of realize what's important. Mm-hmm. And with distance, you also start to really cherish the rare moments that you are together. And with my mom and dad, they realized that they really had me for rare moments, for rare parts of the year, because now I'm like living abroad and living across the country. Mm-hmm. And so I think for them, it was, you know what, we're going to make this work because we want you to have a good time when you're here. We want you to feel loved. We want you to feel, you know, that we're here for you. And they didn't want, they didn't want our interactions, as rare as they were now going to become, to be filled with, you know, consternation, with arguments, with ire. Also, to my mother's credit, she also joined PFLAG. So she became a PFLAG mom, not quite to the level of that one character in The American Queer as Folk that wore all like the pins on her vest.
I remember that.
She did join a local PFLAG chapter, and she actually became a resource for other Filipino mothers and other Asian mothers who had LGBTQ children. And that's basically been their journey. They've had this journey of like feeling at first, you know, shame, feelings, you know, concern about keeping face, about, you know, like about making sure that we maintain the family honor, and then eventually realize that it was more important to love their child and to have a relationship with their child. And that, you know, they started to grow in this advocacy of LGBTQ people and started to really grow in their understanding of what it really means to be a parent to an LGBTQ child and be an advocate and a defender of their rights and whatnot. And also remember at this time, this is when America was starting to go through the same-sex marriage debates. There was a lot of conversations about LGBTQ equality. And so they were seeing that in the news, and they were seeing how people were really calling their son basically abhorrent. I was going to cause the downfall of democracy. You know, and suddenly, and people like me were basically evil. And I think to them that really struck a chord because they didn't want their son to be characterized in that way. And so I think the journey has been that, you know, they on themselves have taken upon themselves to understand culture, you know, to understand LGBTQ history and whatnot to themselves. And then eventually when time came that I would marry my husband, they were open arms because if nothing else, they knew that love is love. And they really started to espouse that. Mm. In fact, actually, shout out to my dad. He actually sent me all of these articles about like gay slang in the Philippines. And started educating me on like gay heroes and gay people and sending me all these articles about Vice and Boy and all these people. I was like, Dad, I got it. I know who they are. It started reminding me that I had, you know, all these gay uncles and you're like, alam mo, you know, yung auntie mo, she is lesbian. Okay. Like, yeah. Like,
wow, they've turned a corner.
Yeah, they definitely turned the corner. So I just want to offer that to all the other Filipinos, and especially Filipino immigrants, you know, is that I want my story to be sort of a story of an example. I don't want to sort of say hope, but at least an example that there are other paths. And maybe this is also an example to other Filipino parents that you can still be a true blue, like absolutely proud Filipino.
It's not too late.
Right. It's not too late. It's never too late. You know, like you can absolutely still love your LGBTQ child and be a defender of their rights and espouse them and be all the things.
Be a good Christian.
Yeah. And still be Christian. Absolutely. You can still go to church. Yeah. You can still espouse all those values. You can still be an upright member of society. And I think in many ways, like many of the people in my book, you can help to start lead sort of that transformation of tradition and of these very, 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 you know, archaic and just frankly destructive perspectives that can start now start to help lead that transformation so that our culture can be more accepting, you know, because it's a beautiful, beautiful culture. But I think we have to challenge all the ways that it isn't necessarily, you know, open to everyone consistently at the same time. And I think particularly that is true of LGBTQ people.
You call your book, Michael, The Wisdom of Gunkles. You describe it in your book as an anthology of very queer and achingly human narratives that are rarely told. And you also said there that originally you meant for it to be something somewhere between a self-help book and a makeup tutorial. So were all these experiences in your family sort of like, did they drive you? Was this the impetus to, wait, I want to tell my story for other queer people and for families who have queer, for all families, you know, because I mean, discrimination happens in many forms and sizes and it's not just to the queer community. Yeah. So was that an impetus for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think actually originally I had intended for this book to be only from my perspective, to only tell my, it was meant to be sort of my version of a memoir that I was writing, you know, to eventually, you know, gift, you know, to my niblings. Actually the original way that I pitched the book to my publisher now was that it was going to be like an Urban Outfitters. I don't know if you have that store in the Philippines, but it was going to be like one of those chic stores, you know, that's sort of like that you see in like, you know, and then those really, really, it's like the Mall of Asia where you see like a furniture store and it's really, really chic. And it's like big coffee table books. And inside it is like, I was hoping there'd be like these really cool line drawings of suave gay men, you know, holding up martini glasses with little like sayings like, yes, girl, you got this. Like, and it was going to be like little bits of advice, you know, little stories here and there, but not necessarily, you know, like frivolous, but, you know, something that people could just pick up and be like, oh, this is cute. Yeah, this is chic. This, okay, this is cool. And then what I started to do was, you know, for this to be truly, you know, universal, also remember I'm a marketer. So I understand the idea of like expanding your readership base, extending.
You went deep.
So that I would want to like have as large of a readership as possible, I decided, you know, I'm going to explore and other people, I'm going to bring other voices in, other experts in their fields. And what I discovered was for me to be able to document and assert their wisdom and really describe their triumph, I had to describe their trauma. You know, I have to go through that journey and anchor all of the joy that they bring to their lives by, of course, you know, articulating the pain that challenged their capacity for joy to begin with. And so I decided to really turn this book into something very different, something that really was a deep look into many, many, many different stories, many different perspectives, and really explore these themes of
code 11.
These things, 11 stories. And these stories are very diverse. They're very intentional about making sure that a majority of them were people of color, that majority of them were immigrants. And many of the immigrants, about all of the immigrants, have stories similar to mine, where we escaped, you know, political turmoil and then came in to America. Many of them are either transgender, gender non-binary, or at least express gender in non-traditional, non-cisgender ways. And many of them are, you know, from very, very different walks of life, you know,
very different.
Yeah. I have a veteran, for example, an African-American veteran from Anchorage, Alaska. I have a African-American wheelchair using disabled professor from Ohio. I have a Paraguayan drag artist, non-binary drag artist in there who's on stage and is really blowing up now, actually. And then we've got, and then, you know, I think, and then I have stories, of course, my story, my husband's story about how he grew up in Peru. And then eventually I encapsulate all these stories with the story of my own uncle, my own Tito, and how that basically compares and contrasts with not just my story, but everyone's stories. And but the really idea was that I wanted to create a story, a book, a collection, an anthology, if you will, that people could see themselves in. And not just LGBTQ people. Actually,
something
I realized is that these stories are not just queer stories. They're immigrant stories.
Universal.
And there's a universality to them. I think definitely probably the most universal theme is definitely this idea of the black sheep. You know, this idea of, you know, the outcast of the family. And for me, I think LGBTQ people are the quintessential examples of a black sheep. You know, we are the ones that are probably the most defiant of all the ways that family and our ancestors defined success. Like we defy what success looks like according to all those, you know, rules. And what I discovered was, you know, there's a little bit of black sheep in all of us, whether we identify as queer or not, because I think in all of us, there's this desire to change things when we feel that it excludes us. But particularly when it comes to LGBTQ people, I think we've had to grow up with this idea that we don't belong in the society in which we are born into. And we can either be assumed into it, or we can try to work to find our way through it or even change it altogether. And I feel like the black sheep is that innovator. They are that norm breaker. They're that rule breaker and the rule definer, right? They're the ones that defy that idea that it's always been like this, right? Because I personally believe that the whole concept of it's always been like this has never moved society forward. We've never progressed as a humanity staying with the same rules over and over again. We've always had to expand and broaden. And the black sheep in the family does that. The black sheep is the one that recognizes, frankly, the bullshit. They're the ones, you know,
calls it out.
They calls it out, right? They're the ones who wonder, like, why aren't I part of the family? Why don't you treat me like X, Y, and Z? Like, why is that? Maybe it's because you need to redefine what the word family means and what it means to be a member of a family altogether. And I feel like every single story has a demonstration of how that black sheep, that character, that person in that story has used their role as that disruptor, as that innovator, as that person who had to find a new path to basically make a new path, not just for themselves, but then eventually you find they make a new path for the generations after them.
What's ironic for me is that, well, speaking as a black sheep myself, and I think Mel, you also mentioned this in episode 2, where you talked about your own rainbow journey, Michael, is that we were considered as the black sheep in the family early on, that we were non-conforming and we were rebellious and that we were different. But then ironically, in the end, towards the end, when you grew older and they found that you were not budging and you were found yourself more and more comfortable into the person that you really were, they suddenly turned to you as the elder kuya or the elder ate, whom the younger people in the family should go to for advice, which is ironic. If I'm so bad, if I was such a black sheep and that you hated my guts when I was so much younger, why are you asking these younger, you know, your younger pamangkins to come to me for advice? Yes. Ikaw nga kumausap dun sa
After Tito, like, I don't know.
Vindication, if there ever was one.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, actually, you mentioned this in one of your last episodes that I listened to, where you know, one of the interesting things about, for example, this podcast and what you guys offer, you know, to the world and to your listeners is that you bring a different sort of cultural perspective, because you do have a different sort of cultural reference as LGBTQ people, as people in queer culture who now also live, you know, in different places, like especially have a different point of reference from your families and how they grew up, that you're able to bring a whole new perspective with different cultural touch points, with different, you know, like, and you're able to amass and bring things right into a different way of seeing the world. And I feel like that's really also what the black sheep does, because the black sheep doesn't fit into a certain, you know, convention. They've had to figure out all the different ways that they needed to either alter that convention or find new conventions in which they would fit. Right. And so that gives, it broadens where, especially, and this is now where the chosen family comes in, many black sheep also find themselves like having to rely on families that they are not born to, or just not by blood, but it's families that affirm them, right? Because they have affinity with them. It's all these people that have similar interests or similar life stories and similar journeys. And that's where you start to realize that there's a whole bigger world out there than what you grew up in. And you start to become that font of knowledge, because suddenly you become sort of like that nexus for all these different sort of avenues of and pathways of how you could live your life.
Oh, probably because due to all of the shit that you make me go,
I've
suddenly, you know, emerged as this, you know, very wise person.
Like a lotus coming out of the mud.
There's a line in your book, Michael, and I'm not going to, please don't allow me to put words in your mouth. There's a line in your book where Tala, your niece who travels cross country from Vegas to DC, she says to you very early on in the book, us black sheeps have to stick together. And I found that this was echoed towards the end of your book as well. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of like, is this, I just thought, no, my takeaway is that, was that what you wanted to, ito ba yung pamana mo as a former black sheep and now having blossomed into the kind of fabulous person that you are now, ito ba yung pamana mo, yung recuerdo, bato ni Darna, so to speak, that you want to give to other people as sort of like, this is your superpower. You know what I mean? Find your family, find other black sheeps to inspire you.
Yeah, black sheeps they're beacons. I was a beacon to my cousin, you know, Tala. I mean, she has a very, very, you know, interesting story. And it was a very heartbreaking story. And, you know, I don't want to get too much because I go into it in the book, but essentially, you know, she was, I also go into this concept of the golden child in the book. I think many, especially LGBTQ people, I know I was sort of, I was the eldest in my family, right? Many, many people, especially LGBTQ people, we are like our mom's favorites, right? Yeah. We are like our family's favorites. Like we're, there's something about it. I think because like we're the obedient ones. We're the ones who get great grades in schools. Yeah. Like we're sort of like elevated.
Responsible.
We're, sort of like, we're responsible, right? Mm-hmm. We're not the ones that are going to go to jail. Like, it's like, we're the ones that the family.
Sometimes.
we're the mabait ones. Is what I would call them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what happens is and that was essentially this sort of like cage that they start to put you in, is this expectation that you will always be, you will always be obedient. You will always be the one that excels. And then you start to defy, you know, all of those expectations by just living your truth. And that's what happened with my cousin. My cousin basically became sort of like she became the vessel for a lot of the immigrant dreams that her side of the family had.
Oh.
So, you know, she married young, she got a career, she bought a house when she was young. And so suddenly she started to embody the American dream, the immigrant dream at a very young age. until we realized that all of that was really for show. Her husband was not good. That's basically essentially cheating on her and like wasting all her money, gambling away. This was also during the housing crisis in America, where a lot of people were foreclosed on. And things of her dream life started to crumble. And she realized that without sort of those badges, you know, of honor, like, you know, I have a house, I have a husband, you know, like this and that. Like, she became sort of like the disappointment. She became the black sheep. And so she fled the country. I'm sorry, she fled Las Vegas, not the
Las
country.
Vegas.
She fled Las Vegas where she was living. And she decided to take a job in DC, you know, very close to me. And I asked her as she was telling me the story, you know, why me? Like, why would you come to DC? And she says, well, I found a job here, but I also wanted to join you because, you know, us black sheep have to stick together. And at that moment, I actually do very distinctly remember in my head, I had to think to myself, am I going to regard this as a brand of shame or a badge of honor? You know? And I was like, is this, should I be?
Yeah, because it can be either way.
She just said it was a black sheep.
Yeah.
I was like, what you call me? Like, girl, what you call me? I'm a black girl. But then I realized, and I was looking at her, and I became her safe harbor. Like, I became the one person in the family. And this is the thing about black sheep, right? Other black sheep or other people who don't feel they don't belong in the family see us as the one place that will not get judged.
That's true.
I know. I'm not going to judge you, right? The way the family judged you. I'm not going to, you know, I want you to know that, you know, and so she's found safety. And I found that that's very, very classic across all of the stories in my book is that, you know, the gunkles do tend to be that safe harbor for anyone in their lives that find themselves to be different, but especially in their families.
I think there's a lot of queer books out there already for like queer people to read, you know, that's inspirational. But I love this book because it's by a Filipino author who's queer. You know what I mean? How hard was it for you, Michael, to get this book published as a queer author? Are publishers open to queer authors? There's what we call like, you know, queer baiting, and you have the queer dollar. Like, how are you comfortable with your book being marketed as a gay book? Or how was it? How hard was it?
So funny. So, you know what? This is where I definitely want to honor our elders and honor our trailblazers and our path makers. But, you know, to the people who created things like Pose and RuPaul's Drag Race and Legendary and all the different kinds of movies, you know, if I were to be a very cynical marketer right now, I would say that it was actually relatively easy for me because my publisher knew that queer sells. LGBTQ stories.
Controversy sells.
Controversy sells, queer stories sell. It's different, it's novel. And they knew that there would be a viable audience out there, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, call it, you know, maybe fetishization, call it a fleeting trend, call it whatever. But, you know, there's a moment at least, I think, in content right now that sort of sees LGBTQ content as, at the very least, interesting, hopefully as human. And credible and worthy and of value, but also something that I think people could definitely see as being marketable and unique. And so I actually didn't have a hard time finding a publisher. I had two books. And I think what actually sold them was this idea of the two book sort of like journey. And what I would eventually actually write for my second book. And when I pitched basically the book in totality, especially the two book part, the part two and the part one and the part two, they definitely sort of like, oh yeah, we definitely want to latch onto that. So the true story of why I wrote this book, honestly, is that my husband and I got married 10 years ago, 5 years before it became legally recognized in the United States. But you know, we've been together for 15, 16 years. We got married for 10. And in the 10 years that we've been married, we've been trying to have a child. We've been trying to, through adoption, through IVF, foster, through all the different ways that, you know, two men, neither of whom have a womb, neither of whom could get pregnant, no matter how hard we try, all the jokes. We couldn't get pregnant. Yeah, we couldn't have a child, right? So there was a moment earlier in the pandemic, like in 2020, where I thought, you know, before everything went to, you know, hell, I opened up basically, you know, my plan, you know, my very, very anally retentive like management plan with an Excel spreadsheet and contact list. Like, this is our plan for childcare. I need your sperm at this moment. And I had a, you know what a Gantt chart is? I had a Gantt chart.
Yeah. Project. It's a project plan.
I had a project plan for our baby. And this is why, by the way, this is why I think LGBTQ parents make amazing parents, because we are super planned and super
ready.
We are ready. Our babies are born from Excel spreadsheets. So I had presented this plan to my husband, and in the midst of this, you know, I was like telling him, you know what, for the past 10 years, I didn't know if I wanted a kid, but now you've taught me that you wanted a kid. Because earlier in our marriage, my husband said, I really want a child. And if you're not ready to have a child, then this marriage is over before it started. Talagang drama shit. I mean, he's Latino, so trust me, he knows how to work a
telenovela. Hindi ka mamang papatalo, you're Filipino.
I know, right? No, so it's like, it's telenovela like a telenovela. Okay?
Yeah.
It's Sharon versus Shakira, okay?
Go, Sharon!
So very early on in our marriage, my husband said, we must have a baby. And I said, okay, maybe. I don't know, maybe. Okay, fine. We'll try to have a baby. And then throughout the end of my marriage, I was like, we must have a baby. I have an Excel spreadsheet. And my husband said, you know what? 3 years ago, my sister had a child. And a couple of years ago, we adopted our adorable little dog. And so I'm good. We don't need a chin. I'm fine.
That's it for me.
And that folder that you spent 8 months prior pouring your heart, soul, and sweat, blood, and tears into. And apparently, I don't quite remember this, but apparently I curled him into a fetal position and told my husband, I literally said, "Batayong baby ko, like you try to kill my child." And that dream basically got transferred into this idea of being a gunkle. This idea of like, you know what? I'm just going to become a gunkle. It's fine. I'm going to pour all the parental love that I would have poured into what would have been a fabulous child into becoming a gunkle, a tito to all these children and all these cousins and people in the world. And then 2 weeks into my sort of like thinking about my book and about to pitch my book, I get a text message from one of my best friends who happens to be a lesbian who says, "Hey, my girlfriend wants your sperm. Want to make a baby?"
Girl, the door is opening.
So I'm obviously Filipino and queer. My husband is Peruvian and queer. Should this be a thing, my baby mama is Afro-Cuban from Florida, and her now fiance is
African-American. Oh my gosh.
And so if we end up having this child, it's going to be like the wokest brown black baby.
How times have changed, no? Parang dati nahihingi ka lang ng asin sa kapitbahay. Ngayon, it's like sperm.
And so,
I got any spare sperm.
And so the book idea is that this first book, Wisdom of Gunkles, is about the wisdom of how I see myself as a gunkle. Mm. And book number two is going to be us making a baby. And
you're already there.
Yeah, actually, I've already written the treatment. The working title is Anako. So Anako or
wow.
Anako. And it's going to be letters to our unborn child. It's going to be letters.
You just gave me goosebumps.
To Anako. And it's going to be, you know, stories about our past, about our family, about our history, and what it means to be to represent these four very, very different lineages and what we pour into this kid.
And if anything, Michael, I mean, this book could be your baby, and it's not just the queer book. I think it's not just the gay book. I think it's a book about family, and family is universal. What can be more universal than family? And the experiences of the characters that I've read, they speak about loneliness, isolation, struggle, disability.
Everyone.
These are all universal concepts, and they're not exclusive to queers. We're probably just more dramatic about them because we're queer. Yeah. And you have a workshop built on this premise also, Michael, right? Like Audacious Authenticity Workshop?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. It's a workshop. So, you know, as a corporate gay, you know, who has worked in corporate.
A very successful one at that.
I know that one way that I can certainly, you know, advance these stories. And for me, it's about really elevating the conversation and broadening the conversation beyond. I mean, let's face it, you know, the predominant idea and the predominant voice in LGBTQ culture, certainly in America, and by extension, I think almost universally, tends to be, you know, white, cis, male. You know, even like the story of Stonewall sometimes gets co-opted, right? And sometimes these ideas of like, what, you know, what should the LGBTQ community prioritize? I mean, like, especially in America, there's been a great conversation, especially, you know, since last summer's Black Lives Matter protests and all those movements, there's been a lot of self-examination in the LGBTQ community about whose voices have led at the expense of other people's, you know, lived narratives and needs. And so there's been a lot of conversations. And really, so what I want to do, especially in these corporate spaces, in these spaces of power, particularly, I want to make sure that their perspective of LGBTQ identity and what LGBTQ identity truly means for them as a community isn't a one-story issue, right? That we really expand beyond the one story and that we start to bring in stories of immigration, of
multidimensional,
trauma, political. Make it really multidimensional and just bring other voices into it. And so the Audacious Authenticity Workshop is my way of bringing the stories of the book into the corporate environment, especially into the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. And how I've done is the way that I structured the book is that every single chapter is encompassed by what I call an archetype. And I did that because I wanted to really create these, singular sort of like, you know, encapsulations of what the wisdoms and what the ideas are encapsulated in each of the chapters. So I have things like the pioneer, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about the person who escapes turmoil in Venezuela and creates almost like a new beachhead, you know, that his family will follow in New York City. I have the explorer, you know, about the African-American, you know, wheelchair using academic who uses travel to really discover who they are. I have the beautiful story of the nerd about my trans who uses cosplay and costumes and sci-fi and fantasy and comic books as a way to create worlds in which they feel safe to then create their own world to make others feel safe. I love that story. And then eventually the story of my tito about, you know, how our elders,
the elder,
the elder who really, you know, paved the path, even though it wasn't a path he recognized at the time, would be something that his future generations of queer, Bamankins would follow. And so these stories, all they have is like, what I did was I basically translated the wisdoms in those stories into what I could see translated into the corporate space. And certainly the idea of the black sheep and this idea of defying and disrupting traditions works
going against the grain,
going against the grain and innovating, right? It really helps basically also position the book in like, you know, technology spaces. So I use that a lot, for example, when I talk to corporations in Silicon Valley, corporations, that are in the tech space. And then I'd say the conversations about, so I have this beautiful story about the chameleon, and it's all about this soldier who navigates his life constantly shifting who he is, who they are, sorry, their pronouns are they, who they are based off of their situation, like a chameleon, right?
And code switching, you called it earlier.
Yep, they code switch. And for those of your listeners who are not familiar with code switching is basically this practice of, you know, switching who you are, whether it's your accent, whether it's your voice, whether it's the way you dress, your
mannerisms,
right? Just to fit in. Or in some cases, diminish the risk of violence and attack. Or in some cases, in the case of the chameleon, actually gain opportunity by making yourself more distinct. And so what they decided at the end of their book is this idea of never dim your light, because then you become a beacon for others to follow. And that's something that definitely in the corporate space really resonates, because there are a lot of people there who don't feel that they can be their true authentic selves, even though literally every single corporate jargony sort of like value out there says, bring your full selves, be authentic, bring yourselves. But what does that really mean, right?
Is the space really safe to be,
right,
to be your true authentic self?
Absolutely. And so what they encompass, and it's certainly something that I personally also espouse in my own professional life, is, you know, by living fully authentically, I try to give other, so because I shine and I try to shine as bright, you know, in my truth and authentically as much as possible, my hope is that it gives other people a permission to shine as well, or to at least have a little bit of their truth, you know, be outed. And so it gives them the permission to be a bit more themselves. And so the story is that it shows corporations that it is possible, especially his context of being, you know, an army person, being in a place in the world that is typically considered very, very conservative, right? If they could do it, you know, maybe it's an example. I think the last story that I usually love to talk about is, you know, really just overall, like I would say, the way that I encompass all the stories into my workshop I always end it with this line, leave a space more welcoming than how you find it. And this idea of, like, for those of us who leave our families and venture into another place, and we find our tribe, we find our chosen families, or we find, and we're fortunate enough to work in corporations that, you know, at least have policies that may protect us, have anti-discrimination policies, have affinity groups, have ways for us to feel that we can be held and can be nurtured. That my goal and my hope, and what I always challenge, especially allies, is that you make sure that that space is protected, that you're always welcome to expand it, so that an expanded definition of who is welcome and accepted in that space can be, you know, it can be broadened, right? That you're leaving a space more welcoming than how you found it.
Which was why I said early on at the start when I introduced you, Michael, that it was very unfortunate that you were doing none of these wonderful things in the Philippines.
Yeah, in the Philippines.
Because Mel, if you remember when we talked to Brian, who is from the Gender Hub in Ateneo de Manila University, I asked him a question like, a research that I found out, there were actually zero companies in the Philippines that have regulations in place to be more, well, not gender, probably is the wrong word.
Philippine-owned companies.
Philippine-owned companies. Yeah. That have zero regulations in place to protect people from different orientations, which
or
is
just
really,
no inclusion really, really and diversity sad. Agenda. It's all led by foreign-owned companies, global corporations. That's very active in those circles, but in local companies, yeah, that's right, zero.
Well, my, I would hope that, you know, companies that do have a presence in the Philippines, and there are very many foreign-owned companies, especially American-based companies, you know, will at least impart that kind of programming and policy creation and safety to their own employees.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may be naive, but I'm hoping that at least starts to influence at least an expectation that that should be the norm elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true. And I, for the company that I work for, we do have, we have that. And I'm actually quite lucky to be
She's spearheading it.
Yeah, the inclusion and diversity team that will drive that for the next fiscal year, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Well, if you ever want to talk about that, I'm a diversity.
Yes, I'm actually taking notes because I will send a proposal to see if I can get you.
Michael, what does literary success for this book mean to you? What does it look like?
Amazon bestsellers list.
yeah, why not? Hey,
yes.
Yeah.
When is
one thing that I definitely discovered in my journey and have evolved in my journey. Is this idea of not being afraid to be mayabang and to have goals. That's
and
actually one thing
it,
that
Michael, I mean,
but it's also like this idea that, you know, it's okay, especially for somebody who embodies our kind of experiences to want to achieve that and to want to create space for us and our stories at that table, especially when that table and that seat at that table is so elusive. Mm-hmm. Why not strive to carve it out, you know, to be there and to help others, you know, basically have similar narratives also be able to get published, have their stories told and to lead the charge and changing content. So yeah, for me, to answer your question, I want to be on this list, but I also want to have opportunities to get these, you know, in the hands of particularly youth. So one thing I'm really, really surprised by and really proud of is the fact that I actually have found a interesting market in two places I did not expect. One was mom book clubs, so mother book clubs, so housewife book clubs, in the suburbs.
Yeah.
And tied to that is educators. So I have had several educators review my book. And I was told recently that in my old high school, I'm being invited to do a reading. It's going to be really heartfelt.
Sort of like a full circle moment.
Yeah.
Walk through the hallways. Run your fingers through the lockers.
Exactly. It's going to be, you know, basically, I think a no doubt.
Smell the pencils.
Smell the pencils. Yeah, exactly. I'll have my heels, obviously. I'll have my red bottoms there and the click clacking in the.
echoing in the hallways.
Absolutely. But I'm going to do a reading with the Gay Straight Alliance and the Christian and English space.
Like
and
a real gunkle. Will you like be sitting in a tomba-tomba? With a hair bun?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. and actually the principal has also said that they're recommending it as reading to be available in the libraries, in the school, and other principals and other educators that have reviewed my book are hoping that it becomes part of reading and available to their students as well. And for me, actually, that's probably the best success. Actually, I would say like with the Amazon thing, actually, I would say, let me revise that. My true success point, what I'm really hoping, is that I get the teacher's pick badge. I actually don't care about Amazon. I want teacher's pick because then I really know that I am reaching, you know,
connecting
the generation that I want to, the nibbles, the nephews. And I want to make sure that they see this as a resource for them.
You mentioned
it's a very easy read. You know how some books are very difficult to read? Your book's very easy to read. Awesome. And I have a degree in English literature from Xavier. And I'm like, this is a very easy book to read. I love it. Maybe it's just because I'm relating so much to it. But yeah, it's a very easy book to read.
Salamat. That makes it, that, thank you. My I asked my mom, I was like, mommy, have you read everything? She's like, Anak, I have to get a dictionary. I get it. Also, what is this word?
Speaking of what is this word, you mentioned nibbling a few times.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
So nibbling is, I can't actually say that I can't claim credit for that word.
Yeah.
It is a gender neutral term for nieces and nephews that actually one of my editors found in an article in like Good Housekeeping in the 50s.
Wow, of all places.
In the 50s.
In the 50s, yeah. It was, you know, they had referred to... In the news, it was like, oh, yes, blah, 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 and your nibblings. And then they explained it. It was like, nibblings, it's a term that you can use for nieces and nephews, but you're too lazy to say nieces and nephews. Just say,
so
the
just
word
say nibblings.
But it never caught on into the overall cultural context. So it sort of died.
And well,
so
let's try again.
And yeah, so my editor like found it and she was like, you know, you should just use this word. I'm like, so yes. So right now I'm trying to own hashtag gunkles, hashtag nibblings, hashtag. So I'm trying to introduce nibblings into the world.
The next few questions, Michael, are more of like rapid fire, all right?
Sure,
your writing space. What are five must-have items around your writing space?
So my writing space right now, because I wrote this during the pandemic, is literally the corner of my pink couch. Literally, I'm pointing it right now. So it is my couch basically being as comfortable as it possibly can be, given how that I literally just wore a groove into it. And then some tea. Actually,
How do you take your tea?
Ginger. I actually do a ginger tea with a little bit of Earl Grey and then some calamansi that I actually have found in the area. So it's like...
Pasha talaga, Mel. Ayala alabang talaga yung tea na.
Yes.
And the other one says, I have been listening to like chill music on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So that's socially in the background. And then of course, my 10-pound little... you know, long-haired chihuahua, usually snuggling next to me. And then my phone, you know, just so that I can like basically, you know, check Twitter and like, you know, check social just to see if I can like get some inspiration and whatnot. But mostly it's really just been like encased myself into like this little ball in my couch. Mm.
Are you going to be reading all of your book reviews? All of it?
I have been told by several friends and mentors in publishing to not read my reviews, not all of them, but then I also got another perspective saying that, you know, as a new author, you should absolutely read every single one of your reviews.
So what are you going to do?
I think I am absolutely going to read all my reviews. I like to think that as a veteran creative and a veteran, you know, director in those spaces, like I know how to take a critique. I've given critiques. I can take critique. Mm-hmm. And I like to see it as data that I can use to make my writing and my storytelling stronger. So yeah, I'm going to read it.
Have you Googled yourself yet?
I have only to make sure that the URL for my book's website comes up.
All right. Tell me if you're uncomfortable answering this, but knowing you, you'll probably answer this with no problem. Your publisher gives you a bonus because your book does really well. Let's claim that. It's going to happen.
Yes.
What are you going to splurge on?
I know exactly what I'm going to splurge on. I'm actually going to splurge on a down payment on a film crew to so I can write and film basically my treatment for my Netflix pitch.
Oh, you mentioned that
exciting.
In passing. Is this, oh my God.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You go, girl.
That's one of the entire reasons also why I wrote this book too, is because I wanted to get into Netflix. I wanted to get these stories into the televisual medium. Mm. And I wanted to own a piece of intellectual property that was uniquely mine and is tied to my name. And then that way I can sell it to or promote it or pitch it to Netflix. And one of the best ways to do that is also to find a film crew to basically find the infrastructure to be able to create like that pilot. So yeah, I
hope that happens.
That was the answer you
it's
were
so
listening
exciting.
To.
It's so exciting.
Oh my gosh. I've actually talked to a Netflix producer. You know what I mean? In the future.
You will look back
at this conversation. Yes. Michael, you have a fashion sense that can only be described as fabulous. I'm not an author, so my vocabulary is not as ornate as yours. So fabulous is the best that I can come up with. So describe your fashion style.
So my fashion style is definitely eclectic, very ethnic. Actually, I like to proudly say that I usually like to wear clothes that would be considered cultural appropriation if white people wore them.
Yeah.
So, when I was last in
only
the
we have the license to do that.
So when I was last in the Philippines, I went gangbusters on buying a lot of local fabrics. Designers. And not just local fabrics, but also local designers. And there's one designer that I absolutely love, and I love repping and talking about their design. It's called Pio Pio. They have a showroom in Manila. I wear this yellow fabric from Isabella, and it's a kimono style sort of fabric. I have worn it on fashion shows. I have worn it to official engagements. Like, I wear it everywhere, and everybody loves it. I also wear a lot of terno tops as well. I'm not wearing it today because I'm dry cleaners, but I love me a good butterfly sleeve. So I would definitely say genderqueer,
really
very, very ethnic. And very, very, I try to be, to represent basically the cultures that I feel I represent as much as possible. I had to be so stereotypical, but I love me some Lady Gaga. Like, I love what she has brought to the dialogue. I love what she has brought to really, you know, to queer, you know, fashion and really espouse that and encapsulate that. And then lately, I've been loving me some Little Nas X because...
How can you not?
You know, to represent that experience in that community, and have that be basically...
So in your face, right?
Yeah. In your face. That bold, audacious authenticity, you know, that I clearly love. Hold that right back.
Do you have to be dressed up when you write?
So get into
a particular mindset?
I do. Actually, I get dressed
really?
Up...
Really?
Let's be real here. It's a pandemic. Like, there are definitely moments where, like, I was in, like, my version of, like, you know, Juicy Couture Velvet, like with a hoodie. And then at some point, there was a moment where I was like, no, I need to honor my Lola.
Yes.
Get dressed. So I, for the past several months, I take a shower, I get dressed, I put on a shirt. Even if I don't leave the house, I do get dressed. And actually, when I write, I do actually get dressed. I do pretend that I am in a space, because for me, it's about honoring that moment. And if I'm going to write my best words, I need to be my best self. And I honestly do feel that I am my best self when I am dressed well, when I'm dressed in clothes that I love. Now, granted, are some of the chapters definitely written through, like, you know, a hoodie that I literally did not take off on several days that I took a shower? Yes, absolutely. There are deadlines. There's this thing in publishing called deadlines, and I didn't know that they were real.
Go write something. I swear there was one interview on video where your hair color matched the color of your blazer. I had to, like, pause and, like,
his
how
hair
do you
now
your
matches
hair color
his shirt.
When
yes,
do you change
so
it?
It's pink and you have pink flowers.
Yes. So my hair. So okay, the story about my hair and why everyone's been asking is like, well, you've been rocking purple pink hair. And by the way, just so you know, I still work. Like, I literally briefed people on a military base with this hair, like, last week. Like, I'm going to the Pentagon next week with this hair. So I'm trying to represent hair color as much as possible. So the reason why I have this hair is because one of my nieces here in DC, actually, full circle, Tala's daughter, who is half Filipino, half African-American, decided that one day she would explore the beauty of her African-American hair and get braids for the first time. And to make herself feel more confident, she decided to weave in pink and purple hair into her braids. And I think she's feeling a little insecure, and she was feeling a little, oh, I don't know if it's cool. Is it cool? I don't know. And because, you know, the gunkle is the ultimate, you know,
supporter.
Sentidora.
Yes.
I said to my cousins, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to get pink or purple hair. So I got pink or purple hair to basically make sure that my niece felt comfortable, and she felt it. That was also the same day that I did her makeup for the first time. So I bought my makeup kit. And then I did a whole thing on her face. She did so cute. And then that just stuck. Like, my whole pink and purple moment was like, you know what? It's the pandemic, damn it. Like, that's the one thing during 2020. I waited until November to color my hair. Like, I'm going to get my money's worth here. So I started just doing it and doing it and doing it until I realized that when I was art directing the cover for my book, I was art directing it based off the colors of my hair. So,
oh, no wonder it's purple. Okay, good. So purple, I was like, it probably represents wisdom. You know, I was trying to.
So as a branding person, I've now branded the colors. It is Gunkle Pink and Wisdom Purple. Wow.
Let's trademark the shit out of it.
Trademark.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Yeah. So my hair is basically a play off of the colors of my book brand.
Okay, choose one. Never write another story or never read another book.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to say, because of the way you phrased your words.
Okay.
Never read another book because there are audiobooks.
Okay.
There are audiobooks and they're usually turned into movies anyway.
Good answer. Good answer. All right. Here's a last few questions. Here's a really good test. My test, Jeff's test on how much of a gunkle, an authentic gunkle you are. And I'll take off brownie points if you don't get this reference. So who are you? Are you Dorothy, Blanche, Rose, or Sophia? Don't disappoint me.
As a gunkle, I am definitely Dorothy. Okay. I am very much I will tell you the truth. I don't care if I hurt your feelings. You know, like I will, you know. Also, I think it's an aspiration because I am very short and she's very tall.
Very tall, okay. Yeah.
Also, I love me a long flowing robe. But I think in terms,
and the shoulder pads.
And the shoulder pads, absolutely. I think out of all four of them, I have always, always gravitated towards Dorothy because I think there was a harshness and a sort of like, you know, a sharp elbow, you know, to her character that I really, I mean, here's what I think about myself. Like my mom actually once said to my husband, you know, we're glad you are here because you're softening Michael's elbows. I was like, I don't, what did you mean by that? Because I can't be, I will say, like, you know, I think a part of my personality, because I've had to survive in corporate America, I've had to be very, very sort of like, like direct.
Yeah, assertive.
A very assertive, which is really funny because growing up, I was known as the Mahin Hin child.
Yeah.
And I was like, I couldn't survive as that child. So I had to be very sort of assertive and sort of, I guess, I can be a little brusque sometimes because I'm very direct with my mannerisms. And so Dorothy was always sort of that to me. I was like, listen, if that old Italian lady can get what she wants in that way.
Call her a Sicilian monkey. Okay, I just thought about this right now. How much of a Blanche were you?
Now or then?
I don't know.
I am more of a Blanche now than I was, I think, in my 20s.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely more of a Blanche now. Cause I think what Blanche encompasses is that sort of confidence in self and that sort of like very sexual confidence, you know, agency, the sort of agency of saying, like, how dare you think that just because I'm an old woman that I don't have sexual agency?
Yeah.
I honestly didn't have that really, even in my queer gay becoming in my 20s, because, you know, I was invisible, you know, I mean, you're Asian, especially Asian in the gay community, particularly here in America, when you're not surrounded by people who look like you, you know,
like minority of a minority,
you have a tendency to disappear. And so I didn't really have sort of like that confidence. I had to grow into that confidence. And I have to say, now being married with my husband, and being open, like we don't understand the word monogamy, frankly, in my relationship. And so we're very open. I deliberately call it monogamy, by the way. I've actually found that, I don't know, maybe because I'm, you know, much more matanda now. I've been called daddy a couple of times and I'm fine with that. I have no problem.
You daddy. Go Blanche.
Yeah. So like I said, I became Blanche.
Okay. All right, Michael, last question. What's your drag name?
Nuance.
Nuance.
Like Beyonce.
Yeah.
And the reason why my name is Nuance, like nuance, is because my superpower is subtlety, and it's not.
Mine is Nipple Brown with a K.
What is it?
Nipple Brown with a K.
Oh, I love it. Mel, do you have one?
No. I've been thinking.
We're going to invite some drag queens.
Yeah.
Talk about RuPaul. You want to talk about RuPaul?
Oh, my God. So how RuPaul Drag Race Philippines just got announced today. And of course, as like the resident Filipino queer of DC, I got tagged left and right by all my friends. At the same time, Manila Luzon just also announced
Drag Den.
Drag Dan. Mm-hmm. So I call that major shade on Wow Presents. Mm-hmm. It's, so it's,
oh my
it's
gosh.
Like, I don't know what's going to happen now. So
I know. Yeah, we'll be torn.
I'm rooting for Manila. You know, I think that's going to be amazing.
Same.
I'm also rooting for RuPaul. I'm really curious. So here's what's going to be interesting is like, if they're going to follow sort of like the España and Holland where and Canada, where they have people from the actual culture actually judge.
Because they don't get it. They don't get the cultural references. Have you seen Drag Race Down Under where they didn't get any of the cultural references?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was horrible. Like basically they judged it. And I think that's actually honestly part of the reason too, why I feel like, you know, RuPaul Drag Race is great. I actually have a joke that I'm convinced that the only reason why RuPaul has all these international shows is because she actually wants to get fracking rights in each other country. So RuPaul really just wants minimal rights. So Philippines, watch out.
I own part of that.
RuPaul's going to come frack Manila, right? Going to frack Pal Volcano.
So Michael, tell our listeners where they can find you and how they can purchase your book.
Hi, thank you. So right now it's www.thewisdomofgunkles.com. It'll be available on Amazon and anywhere that you get your books online. You can also find me on Instagram at Michael Dumlau and also under the hashtags, The Wisdom of Gunkles, #Gunkles, #Gunkle. You can also find me on Facebook and LinkedIn under my name.
And Anakko is when do we expect Anakko to come out?
Anakko comes after I first publish this book and then I have time.
Okay.
I have time to write.
And the Netflix show? You're so excited already. All right. Thank you very much, Michael. We've taken way too much of your time already. It was an honor. It was fabulous talking to you.
Yes. So fabulous. I'm so honored as well. This has been really great. It's great to connect also with fellow queer Pinoys. That was so important for me to have this moment. And so thank you so much for the space. And I'm really, really proud. And I'm so proud of you guys too for creating such a beautiful.
Thank you.
You know, this, I mean, you guys have just amazing content that I've listened to a lot of it. I mean, you literally taught me the Latinate of Palacio, if I'm going to say. Actually, I think y'all should write a book. I think y'all should manifest this in that sort of medium.
You have just been served. This has been the Balut Kiki Project, uniquely Pinoy, unapologetically queer. We are now declaring this project complete. Are we off air yet? Because these hills are killing me.
Thank you for clicking play. Don't forget to subscribe or follow on your favorite podcast streaming platform. And leave us a 5-star rating if you enjoyed the show.